the third lecture, I started by saying that Nietzsche considered himself the first philosopher who was also a psychologist. I threw some doubt on that claim. He wasn't the first. Nevertheless, essential to understanding Nietzsche is understanding that psychology pervades almost all of his philosophical work. In particular, he engages in what philosophers sometimes call moral psychology. He looks into the origins, the motives of morality. He looks into the psychological nature of morality. And as I said, instead of the usual philosophical procedure of trying to justify morals and particular moral laws, what he does instead is he tries to explain them, and explain them psychologically. This makes him an obvious kin with Freud and the psychoanalysts to follow, because what he's doing could easily be called depth psychology. He's looking for the motives. He's looking for the sources and origins of urges and drives, which may well be unconscious and not readily accessible to the person who has them. Now, of course, once you start talking about the unconscious, once you start talking about things going on in a person's mind that he or she might not know about, then, of course, the field is open to all kinds of suggestions. And Freud and some of his more zany followers certainly explored this in lavish detail. With Nietzsche, it's very often a delight of the different sort. It's not so much finding outrageous motives, so much as it's finding unexpected motives. In fact, even the opposite of what it seems to be. In this, he resembles some of the recent postmodernists. I'm thinking of Jacques Derrida in particular, who like to talk about the play of opposites. Here's a very innocent example. In one of his early works, Daybreak, Nietzsche considers the very old hypothesis that if you are virtuous, it will make you happy. This is something that Socrates argued. It was something that's pretty clear in Aristotle, even in the Stoics and some of the later philosophers. Nietzsche turns this around, and what he says instead is that it's only if you are in some sense happy that you are more likely to be virtuous. That's a fairly innocent claim, but it gives an example of the sort of thing I have in mind, where a motive is usually attributed to be this because it makes us think well of ourselves. Nietzsche will say the real motive is, in fact, precisely the opposite. This is true of philosophy as well. Philosophers often produce philosophies in the abstract, in very impersonal, even mathematical language. The idea being that philosophy is something that is universal. Philosophy is something that has to do with reason alone. Philosophy is something that is in no way directly connected with the author, except for the fact that he or she happened to produce it. But Nietzsche says that every philosophy, in fact, is a personal confession, a kind of memoir. And he adds to that that every philosophy really has a moral root, a moral prejudice. And so what he wants to do is to unroot some of these moral prejudices and see just what they are. One of his targets, of course, is going to be his mentor, Schopenhauer, who may have been a hero in his early years, but much later on turns into the target of a good many of Nietzsche's attacks. Schopenhauer had a view of personal character, which he thought made each of us an individual. But he also gave the strong impression that personal character was something that we were stuck with. It's Schopenhauer, among some others, who came up with the very witty and memorable phrase that by the age of 40, a person has the face that he or she deserves. There's a sense in which your character sort of emerges as a fixed part of your personality. And Schopenhauer thinks that this is something that we're more or less born with, but in any case, it's something that we can't control. It's in the hands of the will, which, as we've seen, is something quite beyond our access. At the same time, Schopenhauer has a very strong defense of compassion. But the notion of compassion, as we'll see, is something that is not as laudatory as Schopenhauer thinks it is. In fact, a great many philosophers have talked about compassion or pity, and they've talked about it as the very root of morality. That's what Schopenhauer does. But Nietzsche, in particular, wants to say that these emotions of pity, compassion, sympathy are in fact precisely the opposite of what they appear. One problem is that Schopenhauer looks at the dark side of life, but he doesn't see beyond that. Nietzsche, with his philosophical psychology, wants to go beyond that and see through it to something brighter. The centerpiece of Nietzsche's moral psychology is a rejection of an important distinction. The distinction is the one that's usually made between morals and self-interest. And we're going to talk about this quite a bit in subsequent lectures. But the basic idea is that we have a dichotomy, and it's easy to see where it comes from. In particular, it's very much a part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, between doing the right thing on the one hand and doing what you want to do on the other, or more boldly, being selfish. This contrast between what you might call altruism or moral behavior on the one hand and self-interest, selfishness, egoism on the other plays a major role in many philosophers. And what Nietzsche wants to do is question the very distinction itself. For one thing, he wants to say that what is in your own self-interest may well be the right thing to do. And on the other, that morality itself, despite its pretenses at something higher, ultimately comes down to a question of self-interest. In fact, it's something of a premise in Nietzsche's philosophy, and in his psychology in particular, to put it one way, that people do what they want to do. That for him is a basic truth. That's not to say that people don't want to do something that they may resist doing, but do it for other reasons. For example, I don't want to go to the dentist, but I don't want to have bad teeth and the expense and pain of extensive dental work later on. So I go to the dentist and I do what I want to do, but I do what I want to do with the intention of saving myself some long-term pain. And sometimes I'll do what I want to do when in fact it coincides with the right thing to do. And the reason why I want to do it may be just the fact that I don't want to be punished, or I don't want to be caught, or I don't want to embarrass myself, or I don't want to lose my friends. So the truth is that when you talk about human behavior, one can talk in a very direct way. People do what they want to do, and there are lots of qualifications, to be sure. Nevertheless, without that, we have a hard time getting a handle on human behavior at all. But of course, this is very much against a good deal of the Christian tradition, a good deal of the moral tradition, which says, for example, that what we want to do really isn't a function, what we ought to do is not a function of what we want to do, but it's rather a function of what we have been commanded to do by God, for example, or by civil authorities. Or, what we ought to do is not a function of what we want to do, but rather it's something that's been imposed upon us by reason, by rational thinking, by a knowledge of long-term consequences, not for ourselves, but for all society. Or, it might even be that we do what we ought to do, even if it's not what we want to do, because of the bite of conscience, this force which in the 19th century in Germany was highly lauded as one of the cornerstones of our moral sensibility. Nietzsche's attitude to conscience can be put in just one very brief aphorism. He said, "The bite of conscience is like the bite of a dog on a rock. It does no good whatsoever." In short, the picture here is that moral psychology begins with what for many of us seems like a fairly obvious starting point, and that is that people do what they are motivated to do. And despite a lot of philosophical and theological dancing around that, nevertheless, that's going to be the starting point, and as we'll see, that's going to have very important implications for the rest of Nietzsche's philosophy. It also follows that a good deal of what we do, even if it's perfectly acceptable, is not necessarily for the reasons that we would attribute to it. For example, We're often kind. We exercise benevolence. And we think of benevolence as part of a basic human trait, perhaps even part of human nature. And again, this is a sort of thesis that goes back to ancient philosophy, goes back to the Chinese philosophy, can be found in rather healthy doses in 18th and 19th century European philosophy. But Nietzsche points out in one of his many plays of opposites that when you are practicing benevolence, what you're often doing is exercising a subtle bit of revenge. When you, for example, are nice to a person, you make them beholden to you. And in doing so, what you're doing in effect is you're making them your inferior. You're making them, in some sense, worse off than they were before, despite the generous gesture that you seem to be giving to them. In the same way, when you feel pity, something now we can talk more about, when you feel pity for someone, the gloss we like to put on top of this is that pity or compassion or sympathy, these are also parts of human nature. Again, a thesis that goes back to the ancients, back to the Chinese, and was rich in the 18th and 19th centuries. When you exercise pity, sympathy, compassion, what you are doing is exercising the altruistic, the benevolent, the kindly part of your spirit. But Nietzsche has a different picture. Now first, let me say again that what he means by pity, or the word he uses for pity, is the word Mitleid, which is often translated compassion as well. For example, it's the word that Schopenhauer uses. And interestingly enough, in Schopenhauer's books, it's translated into English as compassion. In Nietzsche's books, it's always translated in English as pity. The difference between them in English, I think, is very revealing. But the basic idea for either translation, or the translation of sympathy, which is something the 18th century English philosophers and Scottish philosophers particularly favored, the argument is basically all the same. That pity is not something laudatory, that is something of which we should have great suspicion. And the prevalence of beggars in Europe at the time was for Nietzsche evidence of precisely the suspiciousness of this particular human sentiment. There are a number of arguments that go through his works. None of them are presented in systematic order. But nevertheless, one can discern four or five different arguments, all of which are intended to make us think differently and much more critically about something which we all too easily simply accept for granted. First argument is fairly clear. If someone else is suffering and I have pity for them, what I am doing is not making them feel any better. I don't alleviate their suffering, but I suffer with them. That's what the word compassion, mitleid, means. I suffer with them. But by so doing, I am not reducing the amount of suffering in the world. I am actually increasing it. To the person who is in pain or the person who is in trouble and his travails, I am now adding my own, admittedly lesser, but still, I am adding to the suffering of the world. I am not resolving it. Second, and this is probably the strongest argument, when you think about having pity for someone, what you are doing, in fact, is casting them in an inferior role. You are looking at them with a kind of contempt. Nietzsche says that pity and fear are contrasting emotions in this sense. Because when you pity someone, you no longer fear them. If you have an enemy, and you can say to the enemy, "I don't hate you, I'm not afraid of you, I just have pity on you," it makes that move very clear. What you're doing is putting the other person down, holding yourself up in a superior position. It's a very powerful psychological tool, but of course, that's not what we admit to ourselves. Third, there's the notion of empathy itself. And Nietzsche casts some, I think, very reasonable doubt about the extent to which we can actually empathize with another person. I remember at the beginning of women's liberation 30 years ago, I got the very common argument from my women friends. "You don't know like what it's like to be a woman in this society." And what could I say but, "You're right, I'm sure I don't." I have had black friends who have said to me, You don't know what it's like to be an African American in contemporary America. And to which I can only give the honest answer, you're right. I can only dimly imagine it. If I have a friend with a broken leg, and I have sympathy, pity for my friend, there's a sense in which you might say, well, I share his suffering, but of course, the pain and inconvenience of a broken leg is nothing like what I am feeling by way of co-suffering. So there's a real question about whether the notion that I suffer with the other person is something that is ultimately intelligible. At best, you might say, it's a very weak, vague shadow of what the other person is going through. And finally, there's the notion that what we do when we pity someone is that we realize not ourselves as superior and them as inferior, but quite the contrary. With some insight and some empathy, we can understand that we share this world, that we are basically subject to the same kinds of plight. This is, in effect, the thesis of Schopenhauer. The reason why compassion plays such a large role in his philosophy is because when we understand the nature of the will, when we understand the fact that we are all victims of this cosmic force, and none of us has all that much control over our lives or our fates, and no real hope for an ultimate meaning to it all, when we understand that, then we have compassion for one another. But Nietzsche says, and I think he's quite right about this, that's kind of pathetic. To think that the reason why we feel pity is because we realize that we're all inferior, because we are all victims, is certainly no noble emotion. And of course, it's the noble emotions that he ultimately wants to promote. In short, the whole story of compassion, he considers just a large hat of hypocrisy, that it is a way of exercising all sorts of dubious motivations and calling them all by a very nice name, a name which, as I say, in many religions and in many philosophies, has done the work of the whole of morality. The most essential bit of moral psychology he does, of course, is his analysis of the emotion of resentment, or he often uses the French more general term, ressentiment. We will talk about that in some detail later on, but let me just say for the moment that his analysis here, too, is that this is an emotion, a reaction, which is very different from what it seems. It seems to be a justified response to injustice. What it really is an expression of hopelessness and weakness. And we'll talk about that at some length. The idea of guilt, which goes along with resentment, in fact, is sort of its mirror side. Those whom you resent, you expect to feel guilt. And in fact, if you can impose guilt, so much the better. Nietzsche points out that the whole of Christianity, in one way, is devoted to resolving the problem of guilt. But, he adds, the problem of guilt was created by Christianity, and so the idea that Christianity is the cure, in a way, is another kind of hypocrisy. It is Christianity that makes people feel guilty to begin with, and then it offers a way out. Or the notion of belief, which may be taken in a religious context, but also I think for Nietzsche can sometimes be considered a property of science, certainly a property of philosophy. Why do people believe things? And I'm not talking about the sort of ordinary functional belief, such as this desk can bear my weight for the rest of this lecture, but we're talking about the larger beliefs, belief in God in particular, belief in a rational universe, belief in some sense of justice that permeates human affairs. The ancient skeptics refused to hold any such beliefs, and they did so on grounds not just that they were delusional, but also on the grounds that a happy human life could not be based on such dogmatic assertions. Nietzsche here is very similar, but again we get a psychological explanation about why people have beliefs, and in particular, why people have absolute beliefs, why they are so sure of their beliefs. And this would extend as well to the notion of absolute values, so much in discussion today. This reflects a kind of basic insecurity, that what we really want to do is to find some anchor, something that's immovable, something to tie ourselves to protect ourselves from the vicissitudes of the world. So Socrates and Plato, most notably, have this notion of goodness and truth, which is in some sense out there in a perfect world. And although we can only get a glimpse of the real thing, nevertheless, it is the anchor, it is the beacon, it is what orients us through our lives and gives us a certain kind of confidence. Or to take one more example, there is the idea of laughter, which is usually considered under the category of jolliness and humor and fun. But Nietzsche points out, what a great many other theorists have pointed out as well, that laughter is, at least sometimes, and perhaps even most of the time, abusive. It's malicious. Aristotle, for example, theorized that laughter was the expression of the superior man over the inferior man. Thomas Hobbes, the English philosopher, suggested that back in history, the roar of laughter was the victory shout of the victor over his opponent. So you picture primitive caveman having just beaten to death his opponent and banging his chest and sort of roaring in laughter. Now we know from cross-cultural studies and so on that different folks in different cultures use laughter in different ways. There are cultures that use laughter as an expression of embarrassment. There are cultures that use laughter as an expression of simple congeniality. There are cultures that use laughter as a pure contempt and disdain. But nevertheless, Nietzsche's thesis would seem to have some plausibility if we think in terms of our own humor and the sorts of things we laugh at, and in particular, the kinds of jokes where we laugh at other people. What presents itself as just good humor, just having fun, it was only a joke, very often is something extremely cutting and malicious. Again, what we do is we ignore the real motivations of our actions, and instead we focus on just the kind of pretty picture that would make us feel good about ourselves. Now, whether or not we're talking about compassion and the many different motives, most of them not very pretty, that go into that particular sentiment, or we're talking about resentment and morality and all the complex of emotions that go on there, which we're going to discuss, or whether we're talking about the rather dark motives that motivate laughter, or the motives that motivate benevolence and acts of kindness. In every case, the key ingredient is that they are, in one way or another, unconscious. Now, that's not Nietzsche's term, although there is a sense in which the unconscious goes all the way through German philosophy. The term itself was really appropriated by Freud. But Nietzsche talks all the time, in very clear terms, that we don't know what is going on inside of us. That, as he puts it, our knowledge of the external world is typically much more acute and much more thorough than our knowledge of what is closest to us, namely ourselves. In particular, what he praises in many different places is the virtue of forgetting. And again, this is one of those reversals that Nietzsche delights in. Forgetting is usually considered a human weakness. In fact, some people would say that not only is it a shame that as you get older, your memory starts to go, something which I can attest to, but rather it's forgetting as such indicates something like poor intellect or a weak mind. And the ideal would be if we could simply remember everything. This is something that people say, obviously without much thought, because if, for example, you remembered not only where you parked your car this morning, but you also remembered equally fervently where you parked your car yesterday and the day before and the day before that and the day before that and the day before that, I think it's probably safe to say that without some sort of temporal marker, you would never find your car. That's a small example. But if, for example, you remembered with present clarity all of the slights that you had suffered in the course of your life, if you remembered all of your failures and embarrassments at every moment, life would be really intolerable. So Nietzsche says, and I think quite accurately, that forgetting is a great human virtue. And one of the theses I'll be producing later on is when we're talking, for example, about justice and vengeance and forgiveness, it turns out that forgetting there, too, is a great virtue, and for fairly obvious, even Christian reasons. But there are many ways of forgetting. And of course, this whole discussion of the underlying, sometimes darker motives of our approved of behavior, all of this requires a kind of forgetting too. Now, there are different ways of thinking of this. The first is in the straight Freudian way, which Nietzsche clearly anticipates, where forgetting is something like the mechanism of repression. But whereas Freud talks about this, at least sometimes, in fairly mechanical terms, Nietzsche is much more of an agency theorist, one might say. He has a great aphorism, one that Freud, again, greatly admired. "I have done that," says my memory. "I did not do that," says my pride. And eventually, my memory yields. It's a very beautiful aphorism because it says so much about what we all do in terms of self-deception. And self-deception here should not be construed in a mechanical way, but rather in a very human way, in a very dynamic way. And of course, there's a kind of paradox that gets generated here. Later existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre would worry about this in some detail. Freud, of course, had a whole theory about it. But basically, the question is, how is it possible for us to know what the truth about ourselves is, and at the same time to deny to ourselves what that truth is? Now, with Freud, there's an actual separation of selves, so that one self, in effect, lies to the other self. In Sartre, it's much more subtle, and it has to do with deflecting your attention and distracting yourself. I think the latter is much closer to what Nietzsche has in mind. But the brief description is that the concept of repression, as it emerges in later psychoanalysts, including the existential psychoanalysts, is something that Nietzsche clearly anticipates, and it's obviously relevant to precisely the kind of phenomenon that we're talking about. The second kind of forgetting comes with religion. Now, in this case, it's not an actual denial, as much as it's something that we might use a religious word and call transcendence. So we don't forget our base motives, but rather we transcend them. We spiritualize them. Now, Nietzsche thinks that sometimes this can be a very good thing, but all too often, it's self-deceptive, it's hypocritical. For example, when I do something really nasty, for example, I insult one of my friends, and I resolve, perhaps to my friend, never to do that again. Well, there's a sense in which I'm trying to minimize the weight of what I've just done and the motive that went behind it by way of saying, in the future, things will be different. And of course, religion on a grand scale, when we're talking about transforming one's soul, when we're talking about reincarnation, when we're talking about a move to another life in which things will be very different, this is all a way of transcending, of looking beyond, of minimizing the rather nasty motives on which we often behave. Third, we rationalize them. The most obvious form of rationalization is when we say of a nasty motive that it really was something else. For example, people will often, quite innocently they think, re-describe what is clearly envy or resentment in terms of a more noble emotion, say, hatred. Now, you might not think of hatred as a noble emotion, but compared with resentment and envy, it certainly is, for reasons that I hope we get into. More sophisticated, you have someone like Kant, where all of this is put down in the name of the inclinations. It is merely our natural forces, our natural character speaking, in favor of reason. So what we do is defended on rational grounds, it is justified, and that sort of eclipses the explanation, the sort of thing that Nietzsche is giving us. Finally, there is the all-important emotion of love. I'm going to spend a whole lecture on that, the next lecture, But there's a quotation that characterizes Nietzsche's view, I think, very well. Love, the subtlest artifice that distinguishes Christianity from other religions, is a word. It speaks of love. There is something so ambiguous and suggestive about the word love, something that speaks to memory and to hope, that even the lowest intelligence and the coldest heart still feel something of the glimmer of this word. The cleverest woman and the most vulgar man recall the relatively least selfish moments of their whole life. This word and the idea it represents is what we'll be talking about in the next lecture. Thank you.